For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up this week, E.J. Harper introduces us to Lazarus Remembered, a novel in words and music written specifically to be an audiobook. Andrew Cullum discusses his life as an RNIB narrator and reveals his favourite reads. And Jessica Townsend takes us behind the scenes of Nevermore, a magical world that rivals that of Harry Potter. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Lazarus Remembered, A Story Told in Words and Music, is E.J. Harper's debut novel and was written specifically as an audiobook. It features a soundtrack with 13 original songs by the author's husband, composer Andy Harper, and is a truly immersive experience. Here's E.J. Harper to tell us more.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Lazarus Remembered certainly throws you straight into the action as Pete, your protagonist, receives a phone call and some bad news.
Yes, that's right. It's literally the first line, and he's given the news that his mother, Lydia, is dying. And we then fairly quickly realise that he hasn't seen his mother for 30 years. In fact, he hasn't seen anyone in his family or his friends back in Australia and his hometown of Lazarus. And the story unfolds to reveal why it is he was exiled, as it were, all that time ago. So we go through a dual timeline, if you like, following his story through his childhood and the events leading to his exile, and then alternating between the current time and his decision to return and face the consequences of that return to Lazarus.
And he is having the week from hell. In the first chapter, you really put him through the mill, don't you?
Yeah, poor Pete. I mean, it all goes wrong. It's just a cascade of events that some are in some ways self-inflicted and others are just pure bad luck. It's actually the culmination of those events that lead to him saying, you know what, things can't get any worse. I may as well just go back and face the consequences of what I did or the decisions I made. So yeah, that's what catapults him into a decision that probably the kind of guy he is, he probably wouldn't have gone back otherwise. He almost needed that push because he's a fairly easygoing person who will do anything to avoid conflict.
He isn't quite hiding from his past in Nottingham, but he's very happy to be a long way away from decisions that he really should have examined 30 years beforehand.
Of course, yeah, you're absolutely right. I guess, like all humans, really, you know, things that we've done in the past, they never really disappear. They're always there, and you come to terms with them, and you can minimise or maximise them in your mind. And he's always aware of this, the events that caused him to walk away from his family and friends and community and everything he had planned. It never leaves him. So he's sort of partially hiding.
And you're very much exploring the tensions that arise from non-traditional family living and the pressures that that puts on people to try and conform.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's actually a subject that I feel very curious about because I think we all have expectations of ourselves and other people, and we don't always realise the impact those expectations have. And they can be at a family level or a community or a societal level. And they cause behaviours that aren't always healthy, even though they're very well intentioned, you know, trying to live up to certain expectations or standards that might go against your own feelings, I think is something everyone deals with. And that's why I think it's quite a relatable story in that way. It's the day-to-day pressure to look and behave a certain way versus the reality of just being a human. And I think that Peter's father, Jeff, who's a character I was always very interested in, you know, the person that will go to any lengths to avoid conflict, to keep the calm, to keep the peace, to maintain a face, which is a lovely sentiment, but actually also in the wrong circumstances has the absolute opposite effect of his intention, which is to look after everyone, and in so doing he actually creates more friction.
Yes, as I read the book, I kept almost looking for scapegoats or people to blame. And actually, I realized that the elephant in the room is that you can't escape your past, and there are decisions that you do have to face up to. And keeping the peace is often just papering over the cracks.
Absolutely, yes, spot on. That's my sentiment exactly. I think sometimes having the difficult discussion is the one that we all know this. We know that it's the healthiest thing to do, but it's much easier sometimes to pretend that things aren't what they are. So yes, that's exactly what it is about. That decision to not face into things, not have the difficult conversations when they're needed, is actually Jeff's undoing and Pete's undoing. Pete's habitual behaviours to run away from things, you know. And actually, one of the things I liked about the character development is as we follow Peter's journey, if you like, literally and metaphorically, you know, him beginning to come to terms with the fact that hiding from things is actually not helping anyone. And all he's doing is repeating the past, all the things. And I think that actually, again, is something I feel quite strongly about. Sometimes the things that you find frustrating about your own family are things you then find yourself doing. You know, you repeat the past. So that was quite an important theme to me. I remember when I was starting to look into creative writing, one of the questions you would always ask about a character is what are the things that they've developed themselves and what are things that actually are a reflection of their community or their family. And this side of people, it was very much something that was instilled in him as a child, and he never really started to deal with till he became a middle-aged man.
And central to the storytelling is the music and the sound effects that illustrate it throughout. At what point in the writing did you decide that this needed to be an audio experience as well as a reading experience?
There are kind of two answers to that. I mean, the first is I'm passionate about storytelling and I love audio. It's my preferred medium of storytelling, having someone else tell me a story. And I love listening to radio plays and audio books because I think there's something magical about someone else taking on characters, and a really great storyteller who varies the pace and the rhythm and uses a microphone well. It's just magical. So I think any story I would tell, I would prefer it to be spoken rather than read. I just think it's a richer, rounder experience. So that's one side. Now, the other side, the very specific point of when I'd started writing the novel, and I hadn't long been into it. It was very much in my mind, and I walk a lot and I run a lot. I'm very much an outdoors person as well. And I remember exactly where I was. I was walking through a field with my dog. I was listening to a podcast, and it was actually an interview with an artist called Benjamin Clementine. And he's a singer-songwriter, and he just released his debut album. And he said, if an album doesn't tell a story, I don't know what it does. And I remember stopping in my tracks and thinking, well, of course, that's true. And I want to tell a story, and my husband a musician and composer, and why would we not take those two mediums and create an even more powerful storytelling experience, because that's what I love. So that is a very specific answer. That moment about, and I was probably about 3 or 4 months into writing it when it was just this epiphany. So I kind of ran home and pitched it to Andy, and he sat back and thought, and he went, yeah, okay. I could just see him sort of thinking, oh, what would this entail? I have to say, if he'd had any idea what it would entail, I don't think he'd been quite as quick to say yes. But yeah, it was at about that point. And now it just seems inconceivable to have done it in any other way, because there's so much more possibility as a writer. So for example, what I began to realise is it's not only just about having a soundtrack, it's about how that soundtrack can move the narrative forward, how it can enhance an emotional touch point. Because for me, the emotion in a story is what I crave, you know, whatever the emotion is, whether it's joy or sadness or anxiety. That to me is a great story, when my emotions are being tapped. And music, of course, can enhance that. And that's really what we try to do, enhance some of the emotional touch points. And then I also realised, actually, it gave me the power to include different points of view. You know, you don't want to be bouncing about in lots of people's heads in the story, and it's almost uniformly from Peter's perspective. But what the music and the lyrics allowed me to do are, on a couple of occasions, move into someone else's head. So there's a song called Twilight, which is actually the perspective of Lydia and what she is perceiving as she's lying in a hospital bed with her family around her, and the fragments of memory that are being triggered. It's not a linear song, if you like. The lyrics aren't linear, but what they are is expressing what Lydia's experience as she hears and touches and smells the people that are familiar to her. And that was just beautiful. It was really interesting to be able to do that, to bring in another point of view. I'm using the power of music and lyrics. And that was nice for me as well, to write a song, which is something I'd never done. So, yes, that's a very long answer to a very short question.
Certainly, I thought the most striking example was Lydia's song Twilight, which, had you brought in that ethereal, broken narrative in any other way, it might have jarred. But as a song, it just seemed perfectly natural.
Oh, that's great. That's fabulous to hear. The process of deciding where a song would sit within the narrative, you know, you've got 12 hours effectively and 13 songs and pieces of music, and actually placing them and knowing how much emphasis to give them is quite time consuming and very thoughtful task. And the one that we could actually definitively say this is where this song belongs was Twilight. And it is very much about the mood and the atmosphere. And it was written because we knew this is the scene when the family will be around her. And we also knew we're going to step into her head. And yes, you're absolutely right. To have tried to do that anywhere else would have been a distraction. And the music should never be a distraction. That was my biggest fear. If you listen to an audiobook, you want a story. Hearing music might pop you out the narrative or change how you're feeling, and it shouldn't. It should really keep you in the narrative and heighten the experience, I would say. So yeah, Twilight was the easiest of all the songs to include.
The other song that really struck me again about Lydia, who is a looming presence in the book, was the song Frankly, which provides a motif for what Lydia is like. Everything is frankly or honestly, which makes you a little wary of what she says as a reader once you've spotted that.
Yeah, very well spotted. I think you're possibly the first person who's picked that up, Red. The interesting thing about that song is Andy wrote that song spontaneously. I remember he walked up to me one day and he said, come and listen to this, I've just written it. And he'd woken up with it in his head. And what I liked about it was the use of the word frankly and honestly. And I said, what I'd like to do is take that and build that into Lydia's speech pattern. And so actually, it was a beautiful example of where the song, in fact, drove part of the writing. And I started to pepper her speech, as you've observed, Red, I started to pepper her speech with the word frankly and honestly. And it did reflect her character. Lydia is very direct, very outspoken, quite a forthright woman of her time, you know, in the 60s, living in a fairly constrained community and not having much chance to realise any of her ambitions. But she is the one who would stand up and fight for something. And that song became, if you like, an ode to disdain. And I've left it open in my own mind as to what she's referring to. That the lyric is, your tragedy, it staggers me, quite honestly, frankly. So one part of me says it's about her own frustration at herself and what she never really achieved. And then another bit is it's how she feels about another character, who in fact is Bob. And that's the most obvious interpretation. And then a bit of it is just about Lazarus, how she felt about this oppressive nature of living in a small town in rural Australia.
The book is brought vividly to life, not just by the music, but also by the fantastic narration of Francesca Tomlinson. How did she become involved in the project?
It's a very good question. Well, actually, so I grew up in the northeast of England in Gateshead, and one of my oldest friends still lives there, and her daughter is Francesca. So I've known Francesca literally since the day she was born. And she studied drama at the Royal Conservatoire in Scotland and graduated 7 or 8 years ago and has been an actor ever since. And it was just obvious to me that Chess, Francesca, I wanted her to do this role. Now, behind that, there's so much agonising that we went through because, of course, the main protagonist, Peter, is male. And to have her narrate it in the first person as a female is not necessarily the obvious choice. But you think, well, the gender's immaterial. If you tell a story well, you forget that very quickly. You know, you're listening to the narrator. So that was one side of it. The other thing, though, was that Peter has lived in the UK for 30 years, so his accent is what I would call a soft Australian accent. Now, Francesca, growing up in Gateshead, is a Geordie, and she really has quite a strong Geordie accent. So not only was she required to deliver the dialogue in different accents, predominantly Welsh and Australian, the main family are Welsh, having moved to Australia, but she actually had to narrate in an Australian accent, which is a real challenge. And as she said, if her agent had called her with this brief, she probably wouldn't have accepted it. But because it was me and Andy, who she's known all her life, she gave it a go. And she came here. Andy has a small studio, and we worked together for 9 days. We sat in the studio, and she just did an amazing job.
There's another memory, hazier than that one. Mum is sitting with the baby on her knee. I touch the baby's face and she smiles. I offer her Buddy, my stuffed monkey. And Mum laughs. The baby pushes Buddy's foot in her mouth, and I laugh too. After that, there's nothing for a few years. My next memory is of Dad. Something had made me furious. At a guess, my little sister Zoe.
Francesca Tomlinson narrating Lazarus Remembered, written by my guest, EJ Harper.
It's quite funny because she came and did that at the end of October in 2019, and it took the best part of 2020 for Andy to go through and technically edit the whole thing. And the studio is upstairs, and literally the soundtrack to my life last year was hearing Chess's voice drifting down the stairs every day. I know every single beat of her voice inside out now.
It's a wonderful departure for me to talk to an author who has written a book specifically to be an audiobook rather than as an afterthought. And I was wondering, when you come to write your second novel, whether you'll be looking to do the same and collaborate with Andy again?
I mean, the answer is yes, I'd love to. I started writing a second novel. It's very, very different. But all the time, as I'm writing it, I'm imagining how it will sound. I'm hearing Chess's voice narrating it. I'm thinking about where it would be appropriate to use music. It's just such a lovely thing to do. It's been a lovely experience working with Andy. We've been married for 25 years, and it's really only in the last 5 years that we've worked together and really got to know each other differently, with all the challenges that that would entail, as you can imagine. But it's just so rewarding when the product is so good, and I think, well, okay, we know how to do this now. We've got a great team of people around us, friends and family, who are incredibly talented and willing to take risks. Why wouldn't we do it again? So the answer is yes. And I think the one thing perhaps we might do differently, the thing we probably wouldn't do again, is take on this huge task of the sound editing. I mean, that would normally be a team of people, you know, and Andy just sat there on his own. But other than that, yeah, definitely do the same thing again. And I would prioritise audio just because I love audio. I think it's a shame that more people haven't really embraced audio books as a way of enjoying storytelling. I don't really understand why it is, but compared to physical or e-books, it's still relatively small, I think. But I do what I can to change that because I really think it's a wonderful medium.
Well, hopefully you and Andy have set an example and a very high benchmark, which nevertheless sounds effortless. You must be delighted, too, that you've provided something that, for those of us with sight loss, feels almost specifically designed for us.
Oh, well, that's a lovely thing to say, honestly. There are so many people that, for whatever reason, reading a book is just not that easy or not even possible. And I always think why we don't take the medium of storytelling and make it accessible to far more people. And I think audiobooks do that. And yeah, I very much want it to be for people that, for whatever reason, aren't able to read or to easily read a book in the traditional sense of reading, if you like. So yes, I'm glad that's how it feels. It's lovely to hear.
EJ Harper, thank you so much for taking us further into the creative world of Lazarus Remembered. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Absolutely. Thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Lazarus Remembered is out now wherever you buy your audiobooks. And EJ Harper will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come this week, Jessica Townsend reveals how Squeezy Crocodiles and the London Underground fed into the magical world of her Nevermore series. But before that, a talking book would be nothing without a narrator, or sometimes two. One of the benefits of life before lockdown, when I was based at the RNIB studios in Camden, is that I got to meet a lot of my favourite voices in the flesh. With life hopefully returning to something like normal soon, let's go back to Camden and seek out an old friend. A narrator I'm always happy to hear reading the titles I download is Andrew Cullum. He's narrated nearly 50 titles in the RNIB Talking Books library alone, many of them spine-tingling thrillers. In fact, just last month he gave me a sleepless night with his reading of James Herbert's The Fog. So it came as rather a surprise when I bumped into him in the green room at the RNIB's Talking Books studio in Camden and found that he's not so scary after all. What led you into the world of audiobooks?
Well, it was something I'd wanted to do for quite a while, really. Ever since I listened to Tim Pigott Smith reading a book by Wilbur Smith called When the Lion Feeds. For years, he became my sort of favourite example of very, very fine audiobook reading. The voices that he created for the characters were so vivid that I could imagine them in my mind's eye. And that remains to this day one of my favourite audiobooks. But I think even before that, even when I was a child, my late father would often read to me just before we would go to bed. And Dad used to do all of the voices. So storytelling is something I've lived with all my life. And it was probably about, it was around about 2011 that I really started to see if I could get some work as an actor in audiobooks. And it was around about that time that I started working with the RNIB, and it kind of grew from there. As an actor, I love dialogue, and I love creating character voices, and audiobooks at their best, for me, are a bit like being in a play and playing all the parts myself.
That's a fantastic way of looking at it. When I was scrolling through the list of books that you've narrated, I worked out that you actually cover 2,500 years of history, because, of course, at the moment you're...
Goodness me, I didn't know that.
You're narrating the second in a series by Valerio Manfredi, I believe.
Valerio Massimo Manfredi. The first book in the series is called Odysseus the Oath, which looks at the start of the Odysseus legend and concludes with the story of the wooden horse of Troy. The second book in that series, which I'm currently working on, is the story of Odysseus's return from the Trojan Wars to his home. The framework of the story of the Odyssey turns up in many contemporary stories as well. In the story Cold Mountain, there is a scene where the lead character encounters sirens. When I happened across this in the story, I thought, oh, hang on a second, these are the sirens from the Odyssey. It's become one of these archetypal stories that seems to crop up. But I have to say that these two books are really well told. A translation I once read of Homer's original was very, very wordy and would be a bit like reading the King James version of the Bible. This retelling, it's very, very accessible. There's excellent dialogue that really lifts off the page. It's a real pleasure to read.
You seem to be the go-to man for SAS thrillers.
Oh, yes, I've done a few of those. Yes, I did some of the Nick Stone thrillers by Andy McNab. Right.
And also Andrew McDermott.
Yes, The Valhalla Prophecy, yes. Was one of them. Yes, those are fast-moving, very accessible thrillers. In some ways, they're not unlike some of the lighter James Bond films, the ones with Roger Moore. They're wildly improbable. Dialogue that is quite funny, quite cheesily so at times, but yes, they're quite fun. The Andy McNab SAS thrillers, they're a lot of fun as well. Nick Stone is the lead character in that, and those books are told very much in the first person, so, you know, I'm sort of using my sort of London voice for that. But they really rattle along like a good un, yeah. There's one called, is it Exit Wound? And then there's, is it Dead Zero? I think so.
I think it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's really good. You know, that's a follow-up to Exit Wound.
You're beginning to scare me and make me consider my next question very carefully. I also noticed that you read one of my favourite books from when I was a young teenager, which has only just become a talking book, Brian Callison's A Flock of Ships.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. When I was in my teens, I went through a phase of reading books by Alistair MacLean.
Me too.
Where Eagles Dare, Ice Station Zebra, HMS Ulysses. There was something about A Flock of Ships that I thought very much keyed into that kind of style. And the writer clearly knew what he was talking about.
It really is a book that stays with you. What do you read for pleasure?
I've always liked thrillers. A recent discovery of mine, well, in the last 10 years or so, is the author Stephen King, who has become one of my firm favourites. I actually think that what Stephen King does the best is personal relationships and realistic characters. And how I discovered him was by reading The Green Mile. When I picked up the book, I was expecting, if I'm honest, I wasn't expecting it to be very good. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I was thinking, oh, horror story writer, probably won't be up to much. I was absolutely blown away. The characters are so realistic that you kind of find yourself wondering what they're getting up to when you're not reading the book. So, yes, he's a firm favourite of mine. One of the earliest books that I really became enthusiastic about, and this is in my mid-teens, was The Chrysalids by John Wyndham. And that remains to this day one of my favourite books. The characters were so real, the dialogue just comes off the page and is so natural. And it's a book I've read several times over my 50-odd years, and I shall probably go back and read again.
Is there another book that you would curl up with on a rainy day and happily reread?
I've got so many books at home, so many books that I love, that I put them on my shelf and I think, yes, I'll reread that again one day, and then 10 years go by and I still haven't. But the next one that I plan to reread is an author I only discovered last year, and actually that was thanks to the RNIB. I was in the studio one day, and in one of my breaks, on the table, there were 100 or so books that had been used as scripts by readers to read audiobooks. And one of them was a book by Zane Grey, whom I'd heard of but never read. This one was a book called Union Pacific. And in common with Zane Grey's other books, it is a Western. And it follows the progress of the Union Pacific Railway across the United States. And I couldn't put it down. I absolutely loved it. This was only last year. And again, it was the characters. And the lead character, sort of seeing everything through their eyes, and the realism of it, I found it really quite compelling. So, yes, that's the next one that's up for a reread.
I noticed that you read a John Ronson book called The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Men Who Stare at Goats, yes. I've actually read a couple of his. The Men Who Stare at Goats, The Psychopath Test, which I also read for the RNIB. And then for pleasure, only about a year or so ago, I read a more recent book of his called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which looks at social media and what happens when it all goes horribly wrong. He's a brilliant investigative journalist. And yes, I admire him hugely, actually, and very accessibly written books as well. This was maybe only about the second audio book I ever read. So I'm going back about nearly 7 years. But from what I remember, there was part of the American military who got it into their heads that they could use psychic powers as a weapon. And the idea was, and where the title of the book comes from, that it would be possible to stare so intently at a living being, in this case a goat, and see if you could actually kill the poor thing. So there were people who actually stared at goats to see if they could actually make this happen. And apocryphally, there is a story that they did actually manage to kill some poor unsuspecting goat. Whether that actually happened or not, I don't know. But there is much in the book about psychic warfare. Anything from staring at a goat to make the poor thing drop dead, or training soldiers to use what they called, if I remember rightly, sparkly eyes, to show that they're nice and friendly and not aggressive. Unbelievable.
Well, Andrew Cullum, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with us and for giving me so many happy hours of listening.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
All the titles that we discussed, and many more besides, are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to E.J. Harper to hear the books of her life, with all the disruption to schooling over the last few months, it can be hard for children and their families to find room to read for pleasure. But the benefits of doing so are enormous, not least in allowing children to step away from the pressures of daily life for a time. The Morrigan Crow series by Jessica Townsend is one of the best that I've come across for secondary school children. The third book in the series, Hollowpox, was published at the tail end of last year, and, coincidentally, deals with a mystery disease sweeping the land of Nevermore. But let's go back a couple of years, to when Morrigan first appeared and Jess visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios. If you haven't already heard of her, Jessica Townsend is a name to remember. Her debut novel, Nevermore, The Trials of Morrigan Crow, is the first in a magical series that's being hailed as the new Harry Potter. No fewer than 8 major publishing houses were vying for the English language rights to Nevermore, and then 20th Century Fox snapped up the film rights. The book's feisty hero, Morrigan Crow, is a cursed child, battling unseen enemies to fulfill a noble quest beyond her understanding. Like J.K. Rowling, Jessica Townsend creates an enchanted and enchanting world that's full of whimsical inventions, colourful characters, and gripping adventure. She's already attracted legions of fans and embarked on a worldwide publicity tour, but she took time off to join me in the studio. Jess Townsend, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, tell us a little bit more about the world of Nevermore.
So Nevermore is an imaginary place. It's a place made up. It's sort of inspired quite a lot by my time in London. And the book Nevermore is about a little girl called Morrigan Crow, who is cursed. So she's born on the wrong day, the unluckiest day, a day called Eventide. And because of this day that she's born, she gets blamed for everything that goes wrong in her world. So there's a little boy who loses a spelling competition and she gets the blame, and someone has a heart attack and she gets the blame, and a school burns down and she gets the blame for that too. The other side of this curse is that Morrigan also knows when she's going to die. So she's supposed to die on her next birthday, but instead she gets rescued and sort of spirited away into this secret magical city called Nevermore. And she's been invited to stay with this strange person in a magical hotel and compete against hundreds of other children to join the Wondrous Society. And she has to have a talent. So all of these hundreds of kids, they all have some kind of talent or a knack for something that is supposed to get them into the Wondrous Society. But the catch is that Morrigan doesn't have one, and she needs to get into the society if she's going to be allowed to stay.
And the wonderful, rather dandyish figure who rescues her is called Jupiter North, who reminded me of all those wonderful characters like Bertie Wooster or so on and so forth. But he's, you know, just like Bertie Wooster, underneath, he's actually a lot smarter than the clothing might make him appear.
Right, and he probably likes coming across as quite silly and not a particularly good adult. I think he is a composite of all of those characters like Bertie Wooster that I grew up, you know, I grew up watching British television and reading British books, so he's very much influenced by that. But yeah, he is a terrible adult, but in some ways he has his moments. He's quite wise and sort of funny.
And it's a wonderfully fun story. I mean, you clearly have really enjoyed writing it and soaked up, well, I guess, everything you've ever read or experienced. It was about 10 years in the making?
Yeah, it took quite a long time. And I mean, that sort of, you know, that side of, you know, really enjoying what I was writing and having fun, honestly, that's the only reason that I think I finished it, because I'm such a procrastinator, like probably every other writer in the world. And, you know, this is the first book that I've written. It's the first kind of whole story that I've completed, and it did take a long time, but it's a result of writing the book that I just desperately wanted to read, and every kind of shiny new idea that I had that could have gone on and been a story in its own right, I just sort of thought, well, I'll just put it in Nevermore. It became a bit of a kitchen sink novel in that way.
And I read somewhere that actually Nevermore spun out from another story that you were writing beforehand.
Right. So way, way, way back in the beginning, I started, I'm not even sure if I started sort of writing much of it. I might have written a few pages, but I was plotting a story about a little girl who went to live with her eccentric Aunt Morrigan. And her Aunt Morrigan was this brave woman who was quite sharp and quite funny and interesting and eccentric. As I was writing that story, I started realizing that the protagonist, this little girl, was quite boring, and her aunt's best friend Hawthorne were the far more interesting people. And I just sort of dialed that back and started thinking about, well, what was she like when she was a little girl? Where did she come from? What happened to her in her childhood that made her so brave and so funny and interesting?
You started writing this, I think I read, when you just finished high school. And whilst you were working at Australia Zoo, were there squeezy crocodiles?
Unlikely, but true, yes. Yeah, so that was my first job straight out of high school. You can clearly hear that I talk funny. I am Australian. I live on the from the Sunshine Coast, which is about 20 minutes from Steve Owen's zoo. And it was my first job out of high school. I was working in a shop, folding T-shirts, selling squeezy crocodiles. And I ended up doing a bunch of other different jobs there. I spent about 5 years there. It's the sort of place where if you kind of just muck in and prove that you're willing to try and willing to work hard, then they'll kind of let you do anything. So weirdly, at the end of that time, I was editing a children's wildlife magazine, which was quite fun.
Well, yeah, and actually it's really refreshing to have an author in the studio who hasn't been through the creative writing courses and right. Isn't painting by numbers, which sometimes it can feel that the creative writing courses teach you to do. And there's a real originality to what you've produced. So you learnt on the job.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, where I'm from, there kind of aren't any, there weren't courses to do. And it was never a thing that occurred to me that was even sort of a possibility. And I loved writing from a really young age. And I guess the thing that I loved about it then and that I still love about it now is that I don't think of it as a collaborative thing. I'm not part of a critique group. I can see the value in those. And in some ways, I'm a little bit envious of writers who have those communities because they really seem to thrive in in them, but I am such an introvert, and part of the appeal of being an author and writing is that I can sit in a dark room by myself for hours, and I'm quite secretive about my writing as well. Nobody sees anything until I'm absolutely ready.
The move to London, you said earlier, was a bit of a catalyst to the story of Nevermore.
Yeah, so I had this character in my head, Morrigan, and when I moved to London was when the city became part of the story. So it was the joining together of placing this character in this magical place. And the thing that I guess Morrigan and I have in common is that she comes to Nevermore and it is this magical city that she has never been to before. And she's just totally blown away by how wonderful it is and how dangerous and fascinating and how much it immediately feels like it's hers and it belongs to her. And I'm not the first person to feel that when I moved to London, and I will definitely not be the last, but it's a city that kind of, it has that effect on people, and it definitely had that effect on me that, you know, I kind of got here fresh off the boat and thought I had never wanted to live in a city before, but I really felt like London was just the most incredible place, and I instantly felt like I belonged here.
You've got a version of the underground called the Wonderground, right, in Nevermore. And reading your descriptions of that reminded me of the sort of peculiar enchantment that I first felt when I came up to London and saw this Victorian underground that keeps the city going. It's just, it's a lovely feeling.
It's actually wonderful to hear you say that, because I feel like I'm screaming into a void where, you know, all my friends from London, they just give me the funniest looks when I talk about how great the underground is. But it is genuinely wonderful. I mean, it transports so many people every day, and all of these lines that crisscross each other under the ground. To me, that's magical, because I come from a place where you wait 40 minutes for a bus. So, and I always find it hilarious when you're on the platform and the little sign comes up that says next train 7 minutes, and everyone just groans in frustration. It's like, no, this is a miracle. Like, we're in the future.
And the Hotel Deucalion, where she stays, is, again, a peculiar and enchanted place. You're clearly a cat lover. The enormous human-sized Magnificat who rules the roost is, anyone who's ever had a cat in their house, I think, would recognise those tendencies.
Right. Yeah, well, I used to have quite a grumpy big cat called Hunter. He was the first pet that was my pet, and I had him for many, many years until he sadly passed away. So I think Fenestra is a little bit of an homage to Hunter. I just love giant grumpy cats. Who doesn't? They're adorable. And Fenestra is one of my favourite characters, and she's the character who most often people tell me is their favourite as well. I think she's quite openly snarky and sarcastic, but she does have this heart of gold, and I have a soft spot for characters who come across as quite abrasive and mean, and then deep down, you know, they're just marshmallow.
And I know we talked a little bit earlier about the influences that have gone into the book. Were you a fan of the Narnia books, for instance, when you were growing up, or did you just read everything?
Well, I actually never read the Narnia books. I read the first one, and I didn't really carry on with Narnia, but I read quite widely. I read fantasy. I loved reading fantasy, but I read a lot of, you know, grown-up books, and I just read anything that people would put in front of me, and all of my teachers knew that I loved to read, and they'd always bring in books that they were recommending. I loved, obviously, Roald Dahl, who doesn't? I loved when the Harry Potter books came out. I loved those and grew up with those, really. My favourite author growing up was John Marsden, who is an Australian author, which I obviously heard of, and he wrote the series Tomorrow When the War Began. It's just a 7-book series, which is brilliant. And I feel like my books are kind of wildly different to those, but I do feel like he definitely influenced me as a writer, especially sort of in his sense of humour. And he brought like a really authentic voice to his characters. And, you know, I hope that's something I've picked up from him.
And do the comparisons to the Harry Potter series add pressure to you? I know at the Frankfurt Book Fair there was a bidding war over which of the publishers was going to represent you and get the English language rights, and obviously the film rights have been sold to 20th Century Fox. Do you feel that puts a pressure on you that you don't particularly like, or are you just very happy to have a full bank balance?
I mean, look, the Frankfurt Book Fair was just slightly ridiculous, and it all happened way, way back in the beginning when I still feel like I have no idea about anything. All of this feels extremely new to me. I mean, I'm thrilled. It's every author's dream to have that kind of response, and it does sort of thrill and baffle the mind a little bit. I don't feel like there's pressure from my publishers or my agent or my editors. I feel just kind of fully propped up and supported, and everyone is just excited to read what comes next. There is a little bit of, I guess, it's not so much even pressure, it's just sort of unreachable expectations whenever anyone mentions the H word and the P word. I love those books and I love J.K. Rowling. But we have Harry Potter. I always felt this way, you know, long before any of this happened, when the next book came along that was like, this is the next Harry Potter, this is the next J.K. Rowling. I just kind of thought, but like, you know, as a fan, as someone who deeply loves these books and this writer, I just think, why do we keep trying to replace them when they still exist in the world? It seems quite silly, but I understand it and I can sympathize with it, because as a big fan, like you are kind of waiting for the next thing that might make you feel the way that you felt when you first read those books. So I understand the longing for it, sure.
Well, quite a few of us are longing for the second book in the Nevermore series. Without putting any pressure on you, how's it going and when can we look forward to having it on our shelves?
It's going really well. It's coming up quite close to the completion of it. It's been a really strange beast writing a second book. It's such a, you know, everyone says that, and every time I spoke to my editor about it, being like, this is kind of weird and it's so different, she would literally just pull out her phone and Google second book syndrome and like scroll through all the results at me. So, you know, I'm not the first person to feel the strangeness of it, because as everyone says, you know, you've got a lifetime to write your first book and then 6 months to write your second one. Luckily for me, I am such a plotter, I'm such a planner, and I am such a daydreamer as well. And I have so much of this series already plotted out and in my head, and I kind of have a very good blueprint. So I definitely wasn't going in blind. But yeah, we should be seeing that in autumn this year, and I have enjoyed aspects of it. And aspects of it have been slightly frustrating, but it's all a big learning curve.
Have you settled on a title yet?
Yes. Would you like to know what it is?
If you're prepared to share.
I am. I wonder if I'm allowed to share the whole thing. I haven't actually asked anyone. Yeah,
I'll
just
what,
do it.
Tell me, and then you can ask Dominic afterwards.
Okay, cool. All right, yeah, sure. So the name of book two is Wondersmith, The Calling of Morrigan Crow.
Well, you heard it here first. And how many books do you think there will be in the series?
Well, I'm planning for 9. I've always planned it as a 9-book series. There will definitely be 3, so I have a 3-book deal. And yeah, no, I hope that there will be 9. It's looking good at the moment. There are good signs that I'll be able to sort of write the whole series, which is fun.
Well, that should give me Christmas presents for the next few years then.
Yeah, job's a good one.
Did you have anything to do with the choice of narrator for the audiobook? Because it's beautifully read by Gemma Whelan.
Isn't it? It's one of my favourite things that has happened in this whole process. Like, it's been a year and a half of just crazy thing after crazy thing. But when I first heard Gemma Whelan reading the audiobook, it's like my brain exploded. They sort of presented it to me as, you know, this is the person that we're thinking of. And yeah, I was stoked. And when she said yes, I was just so pleased. She is so talented. And I listen to quite a lot of audiobooks because I have this thing in the last year or so where every time I pick up a physical book to read it, I just feel quite guilty that I'm not sitting down working on my own book. But audiobooks, they're a different matter. You can listen to them on public transport and when you're doing your makeup and when you're cooking and so on. So I've been listening to a lot of them, and I know that I have a bias because she's reading my book. But I genuinely think that this is one of the best audiobooks that I've ever heard, purely down to her talent. She's so, just all of the different voices, and I didn't even realize until I listened to it how many speaking parts there are in this book. And she comes up with this voice and this character for every single one of them. And anytime anyone brings up the audiobook to me, they immediately regret it, because I will just gush endlessly about how wonderful I think it is.
I can recommend several excellent child psychologists in the greater Jacquefax area. The new caseworker hadn't touched her tea and biscuits. She'd travelled 2.5 hours from the capital by rail that morning and walked from the train station to Crow Manor in a wretched drizzle. Her wet hair was plastered to her head, her coat soaked through. Morrigan was struggling to think of a better remedy for this misery than tea and biscuits, but the woman didn't seem interested.
I didn't make the tea, said Morrigan, if that's what you're worried about.
The woman ignored her.
Dr. Fielding is famous for his work with cursed children. I'm sure you've heard of him. Dr. Llewellyn is also highly regarded, if you like a gentler, more maternal approach. Morrigan's father cleared his throat uncomfortably. That won't be necessary.
What I think is so wonderful about her is that she gets all the characters. The villains and the heroes are usually any narrator concentrates on, but even the little bit part characters who pop up, you immediately recognise that voice from, I don't know, 50 pages beforehand. And she's got your villains down to a T as well, though.
She does, yes. My favourite voice, actually, is... well, I don't want to give any spoilers for anyone who hasn't read the book, but my favourite voice is actually Mr. Jones. The fact that she made Mr. Jones Welsh. I thought, I mean, it makes sense, I suppose, but I hadn't anticipated it, and I just love it so much. And you're right, every little voice, every small character is so distinct, and she's put so much thought into it. The whole thing is so thoughtful. She's really read the book and thought about how these people should sound, and I just love her.
And you must be delighted that actually through audiobooks you're getting to a whole audience who couldn't read the physical print copies.
I am. I think that's just amazing that it can kind of be shared with this whole group who wouldn't otherwise. It surprises me that every book isn't an audiobook. I'm not sure what kind of sort of percentage of books actually get made into audiobooks, but I am thrilled and just delighted, and I feel extremely fortunate that Nevermore has been made into an audiobook for exactly that reason.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed that Gemma is going to do books 2, 3, 4.
Oh, absolutely. I'm holding on to her. She doesn't even know it.
You're obviously doing a world tour at the moment as well, which is quite exciting. Are you going around the rest of the UK?
Yeah, so I've got this week we're doing, because the paperback is just coming out this week. So this week we're doing some school events. I started yesterday with some schools up north, which was lovely. Lots of cute little faces. And then next week we'll be doing some bookstores. I'm sort of living part-time in the UK and part-time in Australia at the moment. So I'm here for a few more months and we'll be doing various events. And we did all, you know, at the end of last year when the hardback came out, we already did sort of Australia, New Zealand and the United States. So now we're going to focus on the UK, which will be delightful because I love going everywhere by train.
And you can write on the train.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Well, Jess Townsend, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I hope you come back when book 2 in the Nevermore series is published.
Thank you so much. I would love to. Thanks for having me.
All 3 of the books in her Morrigan Crowe series are available in print, ebook, and those terrific audiobook versions, wherever you buy your books.
Now it's back to E.J. Harper for the books of her life. So, Jean, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I think the one that made me fall in love with reading as a child, I remember The Magic of the Lion, The Witch and the Wardrobe, so The Chronicles of Narnia. And honestly, to this day, if I see a wardrobe, open it, there's a little tiny bit of me that still hopes maybe it's that magic is real. And I'm just going to quickly throw in another one which has made me want to become an author, which is Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, which I adore. That is the book that I remember reading and thinking, oh, imagine writing something like this, and the power of the dark psychological thriller, if you like, and the way you can manipulate the reader into thinking one thing and then realising that they were totally wrong. I like that idea. So yes, I think I've thrown in 2 there very, very naughtily.
Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me. There was a padlock and a chain upon the gate. I called in my dream to the lodgekeeper and had no answer, and peering closer through the rusted spokes of the gate, I saw that the lodge was uninhabited.
Juanita Jimenez narrating Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, which is also available in Braille from the RNIB library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
The one I would pick here is The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne. I listen to it on audio, and most of my books are audio. But that is a book that I listened to, I think, probably 2 or 3 years ago. And I'd only ever listened to The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas prior to that, so I didn't know much about John Boyne, and I was just blown away by it. I love a good family saga, as you probably guessed. I mean, it would be my preferred genre. And it just had everything. And it's a book that the humour is just wonderful. I mean, I cried with laughter at the beginning. And then several hundred pages later, it broke my heart. I remember sitting on the kitchen floor crying tears of grief at the end. It was just, but that's what I want. And it's such a beautifully written book, and there's so many fabulous scenes within it. It's one that I go back to and listen with pure joy. Wonderful.
So it's up to the pair of you.
My mother told Sean and Smoot that night as they sat together in the Brazen Head, eating a good stew that they shared out between them from a ceramic tureen.
I can go next week when I get my first week's pay, or I can stay in the flat on Chatham Street until after the baby's born and give you a third of what I earn in the meantime to cover my rent. I'd like to stay, as it's comfortable and you're the only two people I know in Dublin. But you've been very good to me since I got here, and I don't want to outstay my welcome.
Stephen Hogan narrating The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne, which is also available in Braille from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Oh, this was a difficult one. I've read so many great ones recently, but I am going to go for The Trick to Time by Kit Duvall. It's the only book I've listened to by Kit Duvall. I think she was better known for My Name is Leon, which I've not yet listened to. The Trick to Time is just wonderful. Again, it's a family drama with a lot of mystery in it. You don't really know what it's about, so you kind of go with it. And then gradually, as events start to unfold and lead to what to me was a shocking revelation, but just so beautifully told with a lovely setting in Ireland and then in Birmingham in the 70s. So a beautiful sense of place and time, and a fabulous central character in Mona. Just a lovely, lovely story, and it really stayed with me.
She makes coffee to wash down the croissant and licks the sugar from her fingers. She'll need to flick a duster over the toys, the building blocks and trains on the lower shelves, over the miniature vans, the wooden alphabets and children's names, mobiles that hang from the ceiling, pull along dogs and cars, aeroplanes and elephants, all carved from beautiful bits of wood, natural or under matte varnish with the grain showing. But they can wait.
Fiona Shaw narrating The Trick to Time by Kit Duvall, which is available commercially and in Braille from the RNIB Library.
EJ Harper, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to all of you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.